We're throwing money at Nauru again, this time about $2.5 billion over maybe 30 years, so we can, once more, park asylum seekers on that tiny little barren island up near the equator. Throwing money at Nauru has by now such an interesting history, we thought we'd have a look at the peaks and troughs of the island's economy to explain why this once rich micronation has to earn a buck these days as Australia's offshore prison. Stuart Firth is a research fellow at the Australian National University and author of Globalisation and Governance in the Pacific Islands. Stuart, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thanks very much, David.
Let's go through the ups and the downs, starting with the ups. How was it that Nauru became one of the richest little nations on Earth?
Well, Nauru became independent in 1968. It was only the second Pacific Islands country to gain independence. And of course, Nauru consists almost entirely of phosphate deposited over thousands of years. And until 1968, it had been foreigners who'd been in charge of removing the phosphate, essentially taking this island away, literally, to spread on the agricultural fields of Britain, New Zealand and Australia. So 1968 comes, and at that point, for the first time ever, the Nauruans gain control of their own phosphate. In fact, in 1946, when they weren't under control of their phosphate, the British phosphate commissioners were giving them 0.5% of the proceeds from...
0.5%?
0.5%. And so this is one of the things that drove the independence movement in Nauru. They were so angry. So having gained the phosphate, they then entered a period in the 1970s, which happens to have been one of the periods of the highest international prices for phosphate. It actually fell again in the 1980s and 1990s. But what it meant was that by the middle of the 1970s, Nauru was estimated to be, per capita, the second richest country in the world after Saudi Arabia, worth $50,000 per annum.
How many capitas were there? What was the population?
At that stage, it was about 6,000 or 7,000.
Yes.
So there wasn't much, it wasn't a huge population to distribute it among. And so at this stage, the Nauruans were spending money like water, because after all, there was so much more to come.
It was endless. It was never going to stop.
It was never going to stop. But then you have to think about what were they spending it on.
Yeah, what did they do with it?
Well, what they did is they turned the whole island population into a public service so that, for example, I read a figure which said that in the 1980s, 98% of those who were employed on Nauru were working for the government. There were 2% were left in private enterprise, but the government paid very well, and so everybody got used to having government jobs, which you really didn't require much effort. In fact, it wasn't all that necessary to turn up, but you did get money.
And I remember from those days a very handsome modern building in Melbourne,
yes,
which was Nauru House, up near Parliament House.
Exactly. That was one of their foreign building investments. They had them in a number, about 6 or 7 countries. The one I knew best was in Hawaii, in Honolulu, between Honolulu and Waikiki, a similar structure to the one in Melbourne. Now, these were not looked after. In the end, the one in Melbourne, they owed so much money on that they didn't maintain it, and it got concrete cancer and had to be sold at a loss. In fact, all of their real estate investments had to be sold at a loss in the end.
Stuart, this immense amount of money, I would imagine, would attract what we might call carpetbaggers.
Yes.
Did that happen?
Well, it did happen in the 1990s. By that time, they were beginning to run out of the big riches, and they persuaded them that the way to continue was not to dig phosphate, but to become entrepreneurs in the London theatre scene, and that what they should do is produce a musical.
And the subject of the musical?
The musical was Leonardo da Vinci, A Love Story.
In love with?
He was in love with the Mona Lisa.
According to the musical, history has another view of the man. But yes. And a roaring success.
Well, not really. On the first night, it was estimated that almost everybody had left the theatre by the time the musical came to an end.
They fled at interval.
Yes. And the musical only lasted a few more weeks, and a lot of money was lost on that.
I presume the 100 or so Nauruans who had chartered a jet to fly to London to be there for the premiere stayed beyond the interval.
Oh, as far as I know, yes.
Yes, to the end, to the bitter end.
To the bitter end.
How much money was lost on that?
Oh, look, I don't know the exact amount of money. By that time, Nauru was losing money on all its investments, really. They did have an intergenerational trust fund, and the figures are that in 1990 there was $1.3 billion Australian dollars in that trust fund, and by 2002 it was $138 million. So even the trust fund was raided. I mean, they virtually declared bankruptcy in about 2003-04.
When the Tampa came over the horizon, bringing those people it had rescued from the sea, those asylum seekers, and Australia was looking for some way to park them, they went all around the Pacific trying to find nations who would take them. Everyone said no, except for
the two most desperate nations, Nauru and Papua New Guinea.
And Nauru at that time, I remember seeing a detail that it had essentially run out of money to pay for the petrol that drove the desalination plant.
That would be right. In fact, I read that the United Nations at this point sent a team in of agricultural experts to teach the Nauruans how to grow food again, because the only food that they'd eaten for 30 years was imported.
So for a few years there, they were Australia's jail, one on Nauru, one on Manus Island.
Yes.
And that eventually came to an end. How much money had it cost Australia by that time? Do you have a figure?
I think it was in about $300 million in that period up to when Rudd closed it down. Might have been a bit less.
That $300 million just disappeared?
Yes.
So what happened to Nauru after that?
Australia actually sent in a kind of intervention force, as they did into the Solomons. Most people don't know this. It didn't get much publicity, but we sent in a small intervention force of accountants and financial experts to clean up the act in Nauru. That was between about 2008, I suppose, and 2010. And that was the period of the interregnum. But the interregnum comes to an end when Kevin Rudd, let's remember it was Kevin Rudd, announced that no refugee coming to Australia by boat
would ever
be granted a residence in Australia, which made the need for the Pacific solution acute again.
And what was Nauru's role then?
The Nauruan government, the one that was elected that worked most with Australia on this, was elected in 2013 at the same time as the Abbott government. And those two events are not unconnected, in that Abbott felt that the Nauruans could more or less do what they liked in terms of, I mean, for example, they managed to make sure that none of the opposition were in the parliament and so on.
Yeah.
But there was never a squeak from Australia about that, because after all, we needed Nauru more than they needed us.
So we couldn't criticise the fact that they were becoming...
New Zealand was quite critical, in fact, cut off their aid. We did nothing.
Right, so we just turned a blind eye.
Yes.
To the misgovernment
of
the island.
Which I might mention occurred to a large extent under David Adiang, who is the present Prime Minister and who recently dropped into Canberra to talk to Penny Wong and others. He was, although he was the justice minister in Nauru from 2013 onwards, the prime minister was Baron Wanga. Wanga doesn't seem to have had much influence, whereas Adiang ran the show, and the show was full of all sorts of mismanagement, which received no criticism from Canberra.
Is Adiang responsible for cutting off the judicial link to Australia?
Yes, he is.
Explain what that was.
Well, there were two positions.
Australian judges who sat
Australian
on their courts.
Judges who were working. That happens in different parts of the Pacific.
Yep.
And they were both, one after the other, sacked.
So the Australians were sacked. Wasn't there also some sort of appeal to an Australian court?
At that point, Nauru's final court of appeal was the High Court of Australia.
Yeah.
And when it came to the question of judiciary, you know, it's a sort of court process involving the people who'd been chucked out of parliament because they're in the opposition. And I think also the judicial ones, those two cases, Nauru suddenly changed and said, well, we won't make the High Court of Australia the final court of appeal at all. We'll have our own one here in Nauru.
Yeah, yeah, don't want that scrutiny.
That was a bit later on. That was in 2018.
So Australia once again has turned to Nauru to park these incredibly dangerous people, Stuart, as you would understand. I mean, there are people who have been to jail and released from jail, and there are about 14,000 Australians are released from jail every year, but these ones, because they came by boat, have to be sent off to an island somewhere. Are they on that island for life? Can they leave that island?
Well, not to my knowledge. There are some, for example, who have no citizenship anywhere and can't therefore leave. Others can't get a visa to anywhere. The government hasn't been clear on that question of the long-term fate of these people. It's only been clear on the question of how much it costs, which is an enormous.
How much a year are they going to be paying?
Well, the initial payment was $407 million, and then that was going to be followed by $70 million a year. And it's all agreed over a 20-year period, which adds up to $2.5 billion.
Stuart, how much do you blame Australia for the collapse of good government on Nauru?
That's a very good question. I think, well, let's go back to the beginning. What we first of all saw from Australia was a direct and highly extractive form of colonialism. From the Germans were there first. They had a phosphate company.
Lost it after the First World War.
Yeah, they lost it. And that became then the Nauru Phosphate Commissioners. So it was a kind of state-run entity, but it was run by Australia, and they gave virtually, you know, no return to the Nauruans for it, but continued to dig phosphate there for Australia, New Zealand and Britain until right up to the end of the 1960s. So there was a long history of very substantial exploitation, out of which comes then this explosion of wealth. I don't know whether you can blame Australia for the... I mean, certainly when you look at other small Pacific countries, they don't have these enormous problems of mismanagement.
But they've never had this enormous
but
wealth
they've never
either.
Had the wealth.
But then when things began to go wrong, and we skipped over a very interesting part of the history of the island, when it became a kind of mafia, a place for mafia money to be laundered.
That's right.
Tell us about that.
Well, that 1999, 2000, and the beginning of 2001, this is when there were Russian banks setting themselves up in Nauru.
And air quotes, ladies and gentlemen, around the word banks.
Yes, that's right. And they're also into the business of selling citizenships. Now, there is an international organisation called the Financial Action Task Force, which cracked down on that. So they intervened to stop this Russian mafia laundering of money. It's said that billions went through there.
Yes.
In that period.
And we can't blame Australia for that. But I wonder about the next step, when Howard is sending people there to be put in prison on Nauru. And yet Nauru's constitution very clearly states that no one can be imprisoned without fair trial.
Yeah.
So Australia was doing something it knew to be unconstitutional, knew to be in contempt of the law of the island. That surely does not encourage lawfulness in the thinking of a little government out there desperate for money.
No, I think that's true. They certainly didn't get lawfulness from them, especially in their operation of parliamentary procedures and so on.
And now, further down the track, once again, with us sending asylum seekers there and paying huge sums of money, your argument, is, I take it, is that Australia is turning a blind eye to everything that is going wrong on the island.
That will be the incentive. And that, I think, helps to also explain the extraordinary secrecy surrounding the recent visit here of David Adiang. Nobody in the government is prepared to say anything about what he did here or what he wanted.
What do you suspect he was doing?
Well, I think it must be something to do with this rumour about the bikie gangs having made themselves, having gained a contract for security in the camp.
Why would he come to Australia to deal with that? Because that's not been rescinded, that contract, has it?
No, it hasn't.
But anyway, he was here for how long? A day or something?
Yes.
And then disappeared again?
Yes. And
how many people have we so far sent to the island?
There's only, well, the fourth went in the last week.
Right.
One, two, three, four.
Four. So what's the future for Nauru?
Well, the future for Nauru, as far as I can see, is continued dependence on money from Australia for, I don't know whether you'd call it strategic services or services of some kind.
Strategic is probably putting a rather nice gloss on
it. It is.
Look, is there any phosphate left? What about digging out more phosphate?
They are digging out more phosphate, and they do export it. It isn't worth very much because there's not much left. Much of the island in the centre has been dug out with these little pinnacles left, and they're taking the pinnacles and exporting them.
Oh, the pinnacles are phosphate, are they? I thought they were rock, but they're phosphate.
Oh, well, yes, I must check on that.
Yeah, but people with shovels are back at the centre of the island.
Okay. But that's not the only thing. It's also seabed mining, the next ecological disaster. And a number of countries in the Pacific, I'm afraid to say, have opened their waters to seabed mining exploration. And one of the decrees, what were they called, that Trump signed off on earlier?
Executive orders.
Executive orders. In fact, in April this year, there was an executive order which was an attempt to arrogate to the United States the right to issue consent for seabed mining.
For the seas of the world?
Yes.
Look, you've always got to have ambitions, Stuart. You know, some people take a sort of a grim view of that kind of thing. But look, it's ambition. Do you see any possibility that seabed mining will not happen?
No. It's too depressing, but I think it'll happen. And Nauru is one of the countries that is very keen for it to happen, and has entered into negotiations with a company in Canada which says it can do it, but they are in active negotiations with Nauru about future seabed mining.
But in the meantime, we will keep sending the people we don't want to Nauru.
Yeah. Nauru, having been regarded as by the UN as one of the poorest countries in the world, in 2021 moved to the high income level.
Courtesy of us.
Courtesy of us. And as long as we pay the big money, which we're paying now, it'll stay in the high income category.
Stuart, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Pleasure.
I've been talking to Stuart Firth, research fellow at the ANU and author of Globalisation and Governance in the Pacific Islands, about the good work Australia is doing out there in the Pacific, particularly in, around and on Nauru.